This is part three of California Dreaming series, The Tale of Who Killed Stacy Stites. If you have not listened to parts one and two, pause this and go back and listen to episodes 111 and 112 first. Then come back to this one and you'll be caught up. Again, I must provide you with this warning. This episode contains details involving graphic violence, sexual assault, and is not suitable for young listeners. Listener discretion is advised. So far in parts one and two, we discussed at length the many pieces of evidence that were critical in convicting Rodney Reed of Stacy Stites' murder back in 1998. And we've also talked about how almost all of the crucial pieces of evidence have either been disproven or retracted ever since. And nothing new has come to light that has further implicated Rodney in having anything to do with this. I do want to quickly address an issue with Rodney's case that was similar to an issue that came up in Kevin Cooper's case that we covered a few weeks ago. Rodney's character. At his sentencing, the prosecution brought up a number of women who claimed to have been sexually assaulted, and their attacker was Rodney Reed. Now, admittedly, I'm not 100% clear about each of the individual accusations, but it was effective in assailing Rodney's character and played a major role in his jury recommending the death penalty to be handed down in his case. If you go to Rodney's Facebook page that I've mentioned in the past two episodes, the admins of that page will be more than happy to break it down for you and explain what it means when somebody says, "Oh, well, Rodney was a rapist. He raped and attacked women before Stacy. He's violent, etc., etc." But before you are so quick to jump all over that, we do have to remember, first and foremost, all of these are allegations and nothing has been proven in court. And Rodney has not been found guilty of anything involving anyone who testified at his sentencing hearing as to what he allegedly did. As a matter of fact, the one sexual assault case that he did go to trial for prior to Stacy's murder, Rodney was acquitted. And secondly, whatever went on with any of that in Rodney's past has nothing to do with Stacy's case. When we look at only the facts of Stacy's murder, I do believe so far in our first two episodes that we have demonstrated that there are some serious issues with the evidence Rodney was convicted on. And that alone should be enough for him to be granted a reprieve. And let's not forget, if we want to measure a man's character, Jimmy Fennell, the last I checked, he's the only person here in our story that has actually pleaded guilty in open court to kidnapping and sexually assaulting a woman and served almost 10 years for that. And that is just the only case that was brought to trial. There were plenty more allegations of Fennell's misconduct with women over the years, and the whole time he was a police officer, charged with the duty to protect and serve. If you ask me, the fact that Jimmy Fennell was a member of law enforcement at the time that he raped a woman, that makes his crimes so much more worse than anything Rodney Reed may have done. Fennell was supposed to be a trusted member of law enforcement. He abused his position as an officer by imparting fear and intimidation in order to assault women behind the protection of his badge and gun. If you are of the mindset that because Rodney had all these accusations going on in his background, then yeah, it's not a huge leap to believe that he would rape and kill Stacy. Then you have to be of the same mindset because Fennell had not only accusations, but an actual guilty plea and conviction going on in his background. It is also not a huge leap to believe that he would kill Stacy out of rage and jealousy. It's tit for tat here. Rodney's got a shady background, and so does Fennell. And I'm just going to say it. Rodney, once his DNA was identified in Stacy's case, he never stood a chance with the white victim, her white fiancé cop, his white colleagues, a white prosecutor, a white judge, an all-white jury, and a white governor. There has been racial bias in this case from day one. Right, Governor Abbott? Texas loves the death penalty. But is the justice colorblind? Prove me wrong. Grant Rodney his reprieve. What have you got to lose, Governor? It's not like he's unwilling to show mercy on a condemned man. He's done it, and he's done it recently. So it's not out of the realm of possibility for Governor Abbott to reconsider a death sentence and grant clemency. You all know what I'm talking about, right? Let me refresh your memory. There was this little, cowardly weasel of a man named Thomas Bart Whitaker. Oh yeah, that guy. He's the one that plotted the assassination of his entire family, which included his own mother, his own father, and his own brother in 2003, so he could gain the family inheritance. He hired a friend with promises of a slice of the inheritance money to lie in wait inside the family home while the family of four went out to dinner to celebrate Whitaker's upcoming graduation from college. But the truth was, Whitaker wasn't graduating from college. He never went to college. He took all the money his family gave him for tuition and partied it up for 4 years. So when it came down to the wire, when the party was over and it was time to get his degree, Whitaker found himself in a jam. So the answer to all of his problems was to off his entire family so he could party on. But the whole plot fell apart. Whitaker's father survived. And when it became clear that his own son was the mastermind, he was arrested and charged with 2 counts of capital murder. Whitaker was convicted and sentenced to death. And he has admitted this was all his doing. So there's no doubt of his guilt. Though he wasn't the trigger person. Well, 30 minutes before Whitaker was to be scheduled to be put to death, Governor Abbott commuted his sentence to life in prison. Turns out, Whitaker's dad, Kent, who was also shot almost to death by the plot his own son orchestrated, pleaded with the governor for clemency, begged him. Governor Abbott met with Kent Whitaker and was moved enough by the meeting to go ahead for only the 3rd time in 4 decades in Texas to commute his son's sentence to life in prison, sparing him from paying for his crimes with his life. So yes, Governor Abbott is willing and able to listen to the pleas of a distraught parent. But what about Rodney's mom? I'm sure she'd love to have a meeting with the governor, but she has never been given the opportunity to speak with him face to face the way Kent Whitaker was. Doesn't Mrs. Reed's pleas for her son matter just as much as Mr. Whitaker's? Maybe they would if Mrs. Reed was as white as Mr. Whitaker. Oh, did I not mention that? Thomas Whitaker is white. Okay. Now the commutation makes a little more sense, doesn't it? Thomas Whitaker didn't deserve it. That was out of the goodness of Governor Abbott's heart. But Rodney Reed, he doesn't just deserve a reprieve. He deserves to have his entire case re-examined and possibly even given a new trial. A reprieve of his execution wouldn't be out of the goodness of Governor Abbott's heart. It would be to maintain the integrity of Rodney's constitutional rights to due process. He has not been given a fair trial here, and until he does, he simply shouldn't be scheduled for execution. Period. So now let's get back to all of the things that have gone off the rails here with Rodney's case, specifically his appeals. We've talked a lot about how medical examiner Dr. Bayardo's opinions meshed with Jimmy Finnell's story to come up with the 3 a.m. time of death, give or take an hour or so. That was the inference Dr. Bayardo made at trial, and the state rode that story to the finish line. The prosecution said, quote, "We know that Stacy didn't get killed at midnight the night before, or at 7 o'clock, or whenever the night before, because Dr. Bayardo tells us that Stacy died within an hour of 3 a.m. Well, dreamers, as it stands today, neither one of those men, neither Bayardo or Finnell, are standing by what they said at trial all those years ago. Dr. Bayardo has recanted his testimony, and Jimmy Finnell is hiding behind the fifth. The time of death presented at trial is literally life or death for Rodney. It was so critical in his conviction. It placed Stacy outside of the home she shared with Finnell, alive and well. In his declaration recanting his testimony, Dr. Bayardo said, quote, "The estimated time of death should not have been used at trial as an accurate statement of when Ms. Stites died." Doctors Baden and Spitz have outlined in detail why the forensic evidence proves that Stacy was murdered before midnight on April 22nd, hours before she was scheduled to leave for work, and during the time Finnell claimed that the two were home alone together. In part, Dr. Spitz explained, quote, "My review of the autopsy report, autopsy photos, crime scene photos, crime scene video, and report of the crime scene investigation leads me to conclude that Stacy Stites was murdered prior to midnight on April 22, 1996. The presence of lividity in these non-dependent areas makes it medically and scientifically impossible that Stacy was killed between 3 and 5 a.m. on the date in question. It is impossible that Stacy was murdered and left in the two-hour time frame asserted by the state at trial." Dr. Baden likewise explained that the presence of non-dependent lividity on the front of Stacy's body was evidence that Stacy was killed 4 to 6 hours prior to her body being removed from the truck and dragged into the brush. Dr. Baden also noted that the post-mortem purge fluid found in the truck would have taken hours to develop, further indicating that she had been dead for a number of hours before midnight when she was placed in the passenger seat of the truck. So when you take this forensic evidence into consideration, it supports that Finnell lied about the events of the night of April 22, 1996. He lied to everybody. He lied to his colleagues. He lied to police. He lied to his best friend, Officer Curtis Davis. He lied to the jury. He lied to Stacy's family. His now contradicted testimony was crucial to the state's case. The state emphasized how consistent Finnell had been, but now, when he may be confronted with his prior statements, Finnell refuses to testify. A second important opinion that the state highlighted to the jury numerous times and to the Criminal Court of Appeals has repeatedly cited Dr. Bayardo's testimony that Stacy was sexually assaulted while she was being strangled with her belt. Dr. Bayardo testified, quote, "We know that the sodomy occurred at the time of Stacy's death, and we know that the semen got in her body at the time of death, and we know whoever raped Stacy is also her killer." He said unequivocally, "Whatever happened to this young girl did not happen consensually. Based on everything he saw, Stacy came to her death as a result of asphyxia due to ligature strangulation associated with sexual assault. But Dr. Bayardo has recanted this testimony in a written statement that read in part, quote, "The presence of spermatozoa in Ms. Stites' vaginal cavity was not evidence of sexual assault. There was no indication that the spermatozoa in Ms. Stites' vaginal cavity was placed there in any fashion other than consensually. Also, because there was no spermatozoa found in Ms. Stites' rectal cavity, there is no evidence that any spermatozoa was deposited in the rectal cavity as a result of a sexual assault." Dr. Baden also found no forensic evidence that Ms. Stites was sexually assaulted in any manner, and he found no evidence of anal intercourse or of sexual assault. And because of all of this, Rodney Reed's defense is now arguing that his DNA cannot have been the proverbial smoking gun that tied him to Stacy's murder, as the prosecution described it as such. The state relied on Dr. Bayardo, Clement, and Blakely to describe Rodney's DNA as the smoking gun and the Cinderella slipper in their presentation to the jury, based on the inference that it could not have possibly been deposited at any other time other than exactly when Stacy was being murdered. The notion that Rodney's DNA irrefutably linked him to Stacy's murder was told to the jury as fact, based on these experts' opinions that semen can remain intact for no more than 24 hours and therefore had to have been deposited simultaneously with Stacy's death. And of these opinions, Rodney's defense team will say are entirely false, and no one, including the witnesses who delivered this testimony at trial, supports them today. The agencies for which Blakely and Clement had been employed have confirmed that their testimonies were scientifically invalid, and so did Dr. Bayardo himself admit that his testimony was invalid, stating, quote, "If the prosecuting attorneys had advised me that they intended to present testimony that spermatozoa cannot remain intact in the vaginal cavity for more than 26 hours and argue that Ms. Stites died within 24 hours of the spermatozoa being deposited, I would have advised them that neither the testimony nor the argument was medically or scientifically supported." He further stated, quote, "I am personally aware of medical literature finding that spermatozoa can remain intact in the vaginal cavity for days after death. Accordingly, in my professional opinion, the spermatozoa I found in Ms. Stites' vaginal cavity could have been deposited days before her death. Further, the fact that I found very few spermatozoa in Ms. Stites' vaginal cavity suggests that it was not deposited within 24 hours of her death." Bode Cellmark Forensics technical leader Stephanie Sivak issued a letter which described Clement's testimony at trial about the length of time sperm can remain intact as quote-unquote unsatisfactory and as an error. The Texas Department of Safety Crime Lab Director Brady Mills also acknowledged the limitations of Blakely's testimony and further admitted that her statement about the quote outside length of time unquote was contrary to the literature that she cited. The paper that Blakely cited stated, quote, "Its data regarding longer times after intercourse, 26 hours, was not a reliable measure of the persistence of intact spermatozoa, and more reliable studies have demonstrated 72 hours as the longest time for intact spermatozoa to be found in the vagina." Dr. Spitz further explained the fallacy of Blakely and Clement's testimony, stating, "Very few sperm were found on an autopsy smear, and the crime scene investigators only found 3 intact spermatozoa. If the victim was sexually assaulted between 3 and 5 a.m. that morning, there would have been more sperm found on the slides. The amount of sperm on the slides is more consistent with the longer interval between intercourse and the time the sample was collected. Intact spermatozoa can be found in the vagina up to 72 hours after sexual intercourse." and Dr. Baden confirmed this in stating, quote, "The testimony at trial that no intact sperm remains in the vagina after 24 hours is not correct. It is my experience and the experience of other forensic pathologists as reported in the forensic science literature that sperm may remain intact for more than 72 hours after intercourse. The few sperm seen are entirely consistent with consensual intercourse that the petitioner, Rodney, has said occurred between midnight and 3 a.m. on April 22, 1996. Now, if you recall, in the years since Stacy's murder, numerous people have come forward on Rodney's behalf to confirm that they were aware of a consensual sexual relationship between him and Stacy, but they were mostly dismissed because they were all friends and family and associates of Rodney's. And I have previously alluded to potential witness intimidation causing many of these individuals to not come forward to testify on Rodney's behalf. Now, in a previous federal habeas proceeding, Magistrate Judge Austin said, quote, "Persuasive evidence that Rodney and Stacy had consensual sex days before the murder would have clearly undermined the state's evidence. Further, given the evidence that Fennell was racially prejudiced, evidence of an interracial affair between Rodney and Stacy would have provided a credible motive for Fennell to kill Stacy." But a credible new witness has since come forward with precisely this evidence. Weeks prior to her death, Stacy confided in a co-worker named Alicia Slater and said that she was not excited about getting married and that she was sleeping with a black guy named Rodney and that she didn't know what her fiancé would do if he found out and that she had to be careful. You can see an interview with Rodney's defense team conducted with Alicia in the 5-part documentary on YouTube that basically lays out all the information that I'm going through here with you today. Alicia discussed how she met Stacy, that they were friends through work, that they didn't work at the same department at HEB, but they would chat during their breaks and lunch. And she points out that she has no dog in the fight. She is not a friend of Rodney's. She just knows what she knows, and she would be willing to testify to it and to take a polygraph. She came forward because she really had no idea how important what she knew could be to Rodney's case. At the time she knew Stacy, she didn't know him. Alicia was only 17 at the time, so she was young. And she probably really hadn't thought anything of it at the time. Another co-worker at HEB named Leroy Ibarra also came forward to state that he observed Stacy and Rodney interacting with one another at the HEB. And based on their interactions, it was his inference that they were romantically involved. Stacy's cousin, Calvin Horton, he too recalled seeing Stacy with the black guy at the Dairy Queen in Bastrop sometime late in 1995. After Rodney's picture had been shown in the media as a suspect in Stacy's death, Calvin Horton identified Rodney as the man that he saw Stacy with. So with all of this forensic evidence and new witnesses that provide credible evidence of Rodney's and Stacy's relationship, his defense would argue that both explains the presence of Rodney's DNA and gives a motive for Fennell to have murdered Stacy. And when you put it all together, new witnesses confirming a relationship, Fennell's refusal to testify about his activities and whereabouts at the time the medical evidence shows that Stacy was murdered, and the recantations of the state's experts, nothing remains of the state's trial theory but a lingering prejudice that consensual interracial relationships did not happen in rural Bastrop, Texas, 1996. As I mentioned in part 2, Rodney was granted a stay of execution in 2015. After a little more than 4 years, on June 26, 2019, the Criminal Court of Appeals entered a cursory denial of habeas relief despite the number of years that they had and the amount of evidence that had been presented during that time, the denial contained no real analysis. When it came to Rodney's 2016 petition, the court said it had reviewed the findings but did not adopt them and the record and denied relief. Its analysis of Rodney's Brady claim consisted of a two-sentence observation that Curtis Davis did not have a perfect recollection of Fennell's statements and made some assumptions based on what he was told. If you recall from part two, Fennell had told Curtis Davis that he had gone out drinking the night that Stacy was killed, but that contradicted his story that he and Stacy had stayed home all night. As for the 2018 petition, the Criminal Court of Appeals stated that Rodney has not shown that his current claims and issues based on the recently obtained letters from the Department of Public Safety and Cellmark could not have been presented in an earlier application based on the factual or legal unavailability of the claim. The Court of Appeals also found that Rodney had not made a prima facie showing of actual innocence and denied the petition as an abuse of the writ. We discussed in the last episode Jimmy Fennell's taking the fifth when it came to answering any questions about Stacy's murder case. Rodney's defense has taken issue with the fact that nobody is taking that fact into consideration. The Texas court's refusal to consider the implication of Fennell's blanket invocation of the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination at the habeas hearing as a part of the Brady materiality analysis was an error on this court's part that should be addressed. Once Fennell invoked the Fifth and refused to testify, the court could not continue to rely on Fennell's trial testimony consistent with the Sixth and Fourteenth Amendments when assessing Rodney's Brady claims. The Sixth Amendment being Rodney's right to confront Fennell, and the 14th being Rodney's right to equal protection. The Criminal Court of Appeals did not discuss the first two elements of the Brady violation, whether the information was favorable and if it was suppressed. But these elements were obviously met. Fennell's prior inconsistent statements to Curtis Davis is classic impeachment evidence, and Davis, who was employed by the lead investigatory agency, knew the information but did not disclose it. In other words, this information was impeachment evidence favorable to Rodney, and it was suppressed when undisclosed information is known by any member of the prosecution team, and that includes Curtis Davis. When Fennell invoked the Fifth at Rodney's evidentiary hearing, it showed that had his previous inconsistent statements to Curtis Davis been disclosed, then Fennell either would have not waived the privilege in the first place, or he would have invoked the privilege when confronted with those statements upon cross-examination, resulting in his testimony being stricken. His invocation of the Fifth in the post-conviction evidentiary hearing demonstrated that the jury would have never heard from Fennell on the topics for which he invoked. Instead, the courts didn't even acknowledge that Rodney Reed had called Fennell to testify at the hearing at all. When a witness testifies for the prosecution during the trial and invokes the Fifth, the Sixth Amendment requires the court to consider whether his invoking the Fifth has prevented the defendant from challenging the reliability of the testimony. In other words, Fennell testified on behalf of the prosecution at Rodney's trial, accusing Rodney of the rape and murder of Stacy, and he was convicted based largely on the information Fennell provided. Now, years later, at the evidentiary hearing, when Rodney wanted to call Fennell to the stand again and question him about his inconsistencies, he took the Fifth. The Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment does not allow a witness to testify voluntarily about something, then invoke the Fifth when questioned about details of that testimony. In doing so, it simply allows for a distortion of the facts by permitting Fennell to pick and choose what he wants to say in his testimony, and this is a violation of Rodney's constitutional rights. When this happens, the court cannot stand by and do nothing, as the court has been doing in Rodney's case every step of the way. And here in this case, the court didn't even acknowledge Fennell's refusal to testify. If a witness refuses to testify when ordered, and there was no waiver of his invoking the fifth, the court can and should strike the witness's testimony, and because the defense is deprived of the right to test the truthfulness of Fennell's testimony, it can lead to a substantial prejudice against the defense. If this conversation with Curtis Davis had been disclosed to the defense at trial, they could have confronted Fennell with it then, and he would have invoked the fifth and never testified at all or refused to confront his inconsistent statements in open court in front of the jury. If this would have happened, the trial judge would have had to have struck Fennell's testimony, which may have had a significant impact on the state's case against Rodney. It was Fennell's testimony that had Stacy leaving the apartment at 3 a.m. and nobody else's. Rodney Reed's attorneys have also based their motion to have his execution stayed based on the fact that a major factor in the basis of his conviction relies on the scientific expert opinions that have since been recanted, and this is a violation of his rights to due process. And they are not wrong. Rodney's attorneys raised this issue based on the admissions of the state's experts that their testimony at Rodney's trial connecting his DNA to the murder was scientifically invalid. Because they told Rodney's trial jury that intact spermatozoa cannot be found in a body after 24 to 26 hours, the state argued that the presence of a small amount of Rodney's intact spermatozoa ruled out the possibility of any earlier consensual sexual encounter that Rodney had been claiming, and he must have sexually assaulted Stacy as a component of the murder. The state's experts now admit that intact spermatozoa may persist in a body for 72 hours or more. Dr. Bayardo himself has even confirmed that the small number of intact spermatozoa that he found indicated that Rodney and Stacy had sex more than 24 hours before her death. Rodney has asked in his habeas application for the criminal courts of appeals to consider the invalid scientific evidence and the state's case having relied on false or misleading testimony. And not only that, the state failed to correct it when it knew or should have known that the testimony was false or misleading. In the United States, a bedrock principle of due process in a criminal trial is that the government may neither present or use false testimony, nor allow testimony known to be false or misleading to stand uncorrected. The introduction of false or misleading testimony is material if the evidence could, in any reasonable likelihood, have affected the judgment of the jury. Did Rodney's jury put a great deal of stock in the fact that the crime scene investigator and the medical examiner both told them, in their expert experience, that because a small number of intact sperm were swabbed from Stacy, that this had to have meant that she was sexually assaulted at the time of her murder? Of course they did. These are experts. They're supposed to be trusted to know what they are saying and presenting. So why the state of Texas and Governor Abbott insists on standing by this conviction and death sentence makes absolutely no sense. How is this not weighing heavily on them? You know what? I bet Governor Abbott's refusal to meet with Rodney's mom, Sandra, probably has something to do with the fact that he would not be able to look the woman in the eye, knowing what he's allowing to happen to her son. It's easier to just turn a blind eye than to face the reality of what he is doing here. So, dreamers, I kind of wondered, why didn't Rodney's defense team call an expert of their own to refute what the state's experts were saying? That happens a lot in criminal cases like this. They sometimes come down to what they call the battle of the experts, and the jury is left to decide which expert's testimony makes the most sense. And sometimes it's just a wash, where the final determination can't be made based on what any expert has to say, so they're left to rely on other evidence presented. I asked Rodney's Facebook page admins about this, and there really is no clear-cut answer here, other than the defense attorneys that Rodney had, and he had two public defenders. And I believe I heard or read somewhere that they were assigned to him 2 months before the start of trial. And that just isn't a lot of time to prepare. Were they not ready? Yeah, probably. Did they not have the resources to hire experts? Yeah, most likely. And did they really have an understanding that the expert testimony was fallacious? Probably not. They likely trusted the experts were doing the right thing. Of course, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has denied all of Rodney's motions for habeas and post-conviction relief pretty much every step of the way. As a matter of fact, the order that was issued by the Criminal Courts of Appeals in dismissing Rodney's due process claims were quite ambiguous, as they stated, quote, "We find the applicant, Rodney, has failed to make a prima facie showing on any of these claims. Therefore, his 2015 subsequent application fails to satisfy any of the exceptions." So with that, Rodney's application was dismissed as an abuse of writ without reviewing the merits of the claims. In other words, they probably just saw Rodney's name at the top of the filing and didn't look beyond that, already set on dismissing it. Nobody is listening to what has happened in Rodney's case since his conviction, and this is just not acceptable. You know, in California, when Judge Aaron Persky sentenced rapist Brock Turner to 6 months for sexually assaulting an unconscious woman, Emily Doe, who we now know is no longer nameless and faceless, her name is Chanel Miller, and she has a book out there to tell her own story in her own way. The state of California was collectively outraged at the lenient sentence for such a violent crime. Just because he was a white, Stanford, Olympic caliber swimmer, he got a slap on the wrist. That judge was recalled 2 years later and voted out. He was also subsequently fired from a tennis coaching job at a high school 1 day after he was hired, when the school was made aware of his connection to the Turner case. So, Texas, if you are unhappy with your judges and the things that they do or don't do, you have a voice and can effect change. Judge Persky's entire career went into the garbage because of one decision that he made that did not sit well with Californians. Texas, do you really want judges serving your counties and jurisdictions that so flippantly dismiss vital evidence like this? I wouldn't like it at all. The Innocence Project, as you know, has prepared all of the information I've just presented to you in their filings on behalf of Rodney, and have insisted that his conviction, and if he is executed, would violate the Constitution of the United States, because they are certain that he is actually innocent of the murder of Stacy Stites. They argue that he has made a comprehensive and persuasive showing of his actual innocence, and it centers on the recanted and discredited expert testimony and the fact that the timeline provided by Fennell must be completely disregarded because of his refusal to testify at the habeas hearing. On October 21st, just a few days ago, the Innocence Project sent a letter to Governor Abbott requesting a reprieve based on all the information I've described above. So, we all are still just waiting on that. Now, I want to get into some of the documentaries that are out there on YouTube. In a 5-part series entitled A Plea for Justice, they lay out many of the facts that I've already gone over, but there are also a few things that I haven't mentioned yet that I want to discuss. First, the time of Stacy's death is discussed, and we've gone over that great deal thus far, as does the documentary. At trial, Dr. Bayardo testified that Stacy died at 3 a.m. In 2002, Bayardo was interviewed by the narrator of the documentary, who asked, "In your trial testimony, you said that the time of death was around 3 a.m. Do you remember how you came to that conclusion?" Bayardo answered, "We know when she was last seen, and we know when the body was found, so we have a precise time." So his findings were based on the report of Jimmy Fennell that Stacy had left the apartment at 3 a.m., not really on anything medical or scientific. Dr. Baden, who I've talked about a lot here, said Stacy had to have been dead by midnight. He discusses in great detail the lividity that we went over in the last episode. He said, quote, "The appearance of Miss Stite's body at the scene where she was found later that afternoon around 3 o'clock shows a pinkish-red color on the front areas of her body that are due to what is called lividity, the settling of blood by gravity after death. And in this instance, there was fixed lividity on the front of her body. That would indicate that she had been face down for 5 or more hours in one position before she was turned over in the new position." And we have already said that neither Blakely nor Bayardo mentioned the presence of fixed lividity in their report or in their testimony. There is video footage of Stacy's body in the documentary, so be warned, it is graphic if you do watch it. But if you do, you can see the presence of the lividity for yourselves. Dr. Baden specifically points out video footage of Stacy's right hand, and he stated at the evidentiary hearing, quote, "This is the right hand, and it shows she is laying face up and the hand up, but the lividity is inappropriate because that would have developed when the hand was down, when the hand and forearm were in a down or downward position. So it would support the conclusion that she was lying face down and the hand and arm were face down for at least 4 to 5 hours in order for this to still be there. What you can see in the tips of the fingers, they have pale whiteness in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th fingers, and that's because of the time that she was laying face down elsewhere, the fingers were against an object which pressed out the lividity. And so it gives some information as to her being face down with her hand down for many hours before she was moved into this position." Next, Dr. Baden addressed the fluids found on the floor of the pickup truck. The amount of the fluid observed there in the photographs of the truck, according to Dr. Baden, was indicative of her being placed and kept in the truck for 3 to 4 hours after she had been killed, and that mucoid-type fluid would have come out of her nose and mouth, which is an early part of the decomposition process after we die. This takes 3 to 4 hours to develop under these conditions that she was in. So again, the time period described by Dr. Baden places Stacy in the company of Jimmy Fennell and Jimmy Fennell alone, and completely exonerates Rodney Reed from having been involved in Stacy's murder, as he simply would not have had access to Stacy or her truck for that long of a period of time. But everyone just had to go by and accept what Dr. Bayardo had testified to at trial. When Dr. Bayardo was asked by the documentarian if he would be surprised if he was told that the defense never called a medical examiner in this case or an expert of their own, and he replied, "I mean, they called me, so I was there. You mean they didn't call any extra, another medical examiner, another expert on this case? No, it doesn't surprise me. These are poor people. Counties do not have the money to pay for experts." And since Dr. Bayardo brought it up, let's talk about money. The documentary goes into how Dr. Bayardo may have had incentives to testify the way that he did, meaning in favor of the prosecution, and there may have been a conflict of interest going on here. In a 2016 investigative report conducted by KXAN, which is Austin's NBC affiliate station, they uncovered a decades-long scheme by Dr. Bayardo to increase his personal earnings by conducting autopsies in counties outside of the one for which he was employed. And Stacy Stites was one of those autopsies for which he was paid $800. So the inference here is prosecutors from counties in and around the Austin area would call upon Dr. Bayardo because he would be willing to work with them in providing them with an autopsy report that would fit their narrative for whatever case it was they were looking to prosecute. So for example, if the prosecutor on Stacy's case, who was Lisa Turner, if she told Dr. Bayardo, hey, you know, I need the time of death to be no earlier than 3 a.m., they knew he would have the incentive to testify to that. When Bayardo's nearly three-decade career as a medical examiner was examined, it showed that he regularly performed anywhere between 400 to more than 800 autopsies a year. I looked it up, and the National Association of Medical Examiners has a recommended number of autopsies that should be conducted by each ME annually as set at 250. That's the standard. But the article also said that most MEs go over that number, and most medical offices do an average of about 700 a year. And Dr. Bayardo has had years that he's done more autopsies than the average medical examiner's office as a whole. The investigation discovered that Bayardo had made about $2.6 million conducting autopsies in a total of 45 counties. So, it's a pretty cozy arrangement for all involved. He keeps getting the work. If he's willing to fudge his testimony to support the prosecutors, who are obviously working for the same counties that are paying him to do the autopsies for them. And this is your taxpayer money here, Texas. It really gets you thinking about the thousands of autopsies that Dr. Bayardo has performed and the thousands of trials that he has provided testimony for, which he also gets paid to do. How many defendants were convicted based on his testimony? Bayardo has denied that he benefits financially from performing these autopsies, that it's all worked out in the expenses, whatever the hell that means. But there is an invoice reflecting the fact that he was paid $800 for Stacy's autopsy. Yet, despite all the shadiness going on with Dr. Bayardo, in conjunction with all of the reliable expert opinions as to Stacy's accurate time of death, the Texas Criminal Court of Appeals continues to refuse to consider anything outside of what was presented at trial. And I told you how the judge, specifically Judge Doug Shaver, asked when Dr. Baden was testifying, is Dr. Baden free to leave? I imagine he has more important things to do. And that's when Dr. Baden told Judge Shaver, this is important. And with that dismissal, Bayardo's testimony still stands to this day as a critical fact in the case against Rodney Reed. It was unchallenged at the time of trial, and when it has been aggressively challenged in the years since, the court continues to brush it aside. Okay, so if you recall in one of Rodney's many denials for any of his petitions, the Criminal Court of Appeals has come to the determination that Rodney's attorneys have failed to prove that no rational juror could have found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But one juror from Rodney's original trial has spoken out. She spoke to Crime Watch Daily, and you can find her interview on YouTube and portions of it in the documentary. She has gone on record by publicly stating that she now has reasonable doubts about Rodney's guilt. She would not appear on camera, so her face is obscured, but she said, quote, since then, there have been a lot of things that I've learned in that 20 years or heard about that have made me wonder if Rodney was framed. Well, what are some of those things that she may have come to learn in the last two decades since she and the jury that she was a part of convicted Rodney and sentenced him to death? Well, she may have found out this little tidbit of information that I have not yet touched on. The beer cans. You see, dreamers, DNA tested from two beer cans found near the area where Stacy was discovered on Bluebonnet Drive contained the DNA of two police officers, David Hall and Ed Salmella. You remember those names? Officer David Hall, if you recall, was a friend, neighbor, co-worker, patrol partner, and co-Little League coach of Jimmy Fennell's. So you can say that the two were pretty close at the time of Stacy's murder. And good old Ed Salmella. If you recall his name, he was an investigator with the Bastrop Police Department and was assigned to Stacy's case at the onset. And we talked about him in part one, that about 6 months after Stacy's death, he ended up dead as a result of a suspicious gunshot wound to the head, which was ruled a suicide by lead investigator on Stacy's case and Ed Salmella's roommate at the time, Texas Ranger LT Wardlow. I have come to find out that at the time, Ranger Wardlow was going through a divorce, and this is the reason why he was roommating with Ed Salmella. Yep, their DNA was found on two beer cans near the scene. But that information was never provided to Rodney's defense team. They did not know about it when Rodney went on trial, and the jury never knew about it. Okay, so I will come back to that juror that has come forward in just a minute. Well, maybe more than a minute. I want to discuss these beer cans. Now, the information about the cans is pretty vague. Of course, the state did not provide the evidence that was yielded from the testing of them. They were tested close to the time of trial, and I can only assume investigators were looking for a result that would implicate Rodney Reed even further. But when the results came back, it looks like it backfired. There was a second round of testing, and after that, the state would claim all samples had been consumed and no further testing would be possible. And I believe in the second round of testing, only David Hall's DNA was identified on the cans. Okay, so they were found near Stacy's body, and at some point they were subjected to DNA testing, and the testing came back as a match to Hall and Salmella, and then eventually just Hall. So I have to ask, how did these two beer cans end up there with these two officers' DNA on them in at least one of the testings of the cans? Well, let's see. This was in Bastrop. So David Hall doesn't work there. He works in Giddings. So could it have been some sort of drinking on the job? Pull off to a side road and have a few beers on patrol? Yeah, I wouldn't put anything past these guys. And if that was the case, it's not a good look for the police department, but certainly a far cry from, oh, say, accessory after the fact. And the cans just so happened to be tossed near where a dead body would later be found. So add littering to the charges against these rogue cops, right? That's a possible explanation, I suppose. It was a coincidence. But did I say accessory after the fact? Yeah, I did. What am I implying here? Well, I mean, come on. Let's just state the obvious. Not everyone is going to want to come out and say it, so I will. What if David Hall was contacted on the night of Stacy's death by Jimmy Fennell after he killed Stacy in their apartment and asked him for help moving the body? Come on, I know you're all thinking it too. This is Fennell's BFF, his cop buddy, you guys. David Hall is Fennell's best friend. There really hasn't been anything established in terms of a relationship between Fennell and Hall and Salmella. Salmella was on the investigation. His DNA was identified, but then it was eliminated. He was roommates with the lead investigator. How it was possible his DNA ended up there might have been some sort of cross-contamination. But there has been an unsubstantiated rumor that Stacy was also having an affair with Ed Salmella. Because I don't know that to be a fact, I'm not going to explore what that could have possibly meant in terms of her death, the investigation, his firing, and his suspicious death 6 months later. But that's just another mysterious thing on the peripheral of this case here. I don't think any of that is coincidental, but I don't know what his firing and supposed suicide has to do with Stacy here. Anyway, back to the beer cans. David Hall's DNA being there is a red flag. Because think about it. If Fennell killed Stacy inside their apartment, he's going to have to figure out what he's going to do next. Because he certainly isn't going to have the integrity to take responsibility for what he did and turn himself in. No. Fennell is no stand-up guy. Not by any stretch of the imagination. So dreamers, to this point, if we have come to believe that Jimmy Fennell is Stacy's killer and not Rodney Reed, then we are naturally going to try to puzzle piece together a new theory as to what really went down that night. In the last episode, I outlined a potential theory as to a motive for Fennell to having been the one to have killed Stacy. That he somehow figured out that she had been cheating on him and this enraged him and he killed her. But I didn't go into anything beyond the killing. This is where we can start speculating about the logistics of how Stacy wound up on Bluebonnet Drive and how Fennell's truck wound up in the Bastrop High School parking lot and how Fennell wound up back at his apartment before the 6:30 to 7 a.m. call from Stacy's mom that she had failed to show up for work. So you're going to have to forgive me now because I'm going to walk away from what we know and towards what we think we know. So assuming that Fennell killed Stacy, which based on the science is almost certain that he did, he obviously did so within the confines of their apartment. She was strangled with her belt and the belt broke into two or more pieces, at least two pieces. Where in the apartment this took place, it's hard to say since the apartment was never searched. And remember, that was by the order of the lead investigator on the case, Ranger Wardlow. He specifically gave instructions for the apartment not to be searched. I don't think I mentioned that yet. But yeah, that was all Ranger Wardlow doing his fellow officer a solid, right? Yeah. The same guy who ruled Ed Salmela's death a suicide, who should have taken himself out of that investigation due to the fact that he was Salmela's roommate. That is a clear conflict of interest, and a different investigator should have been assigned to it. That's the same guy who gave Fennell his truck back just days after the murder as well, and after which Fennell got rid of it immediately. So, what does Fennell have to do next? He needs to cover up what he's done, right? So, based on the lividity evidence present on Stacy's body when she was found, we can assume that she is dead and face down at this point. And it happened sometime between approximately 9 p.m. and midnight on the evening of April 22nd. I don't often like to look at the nuances of what people say or try to read between the lines or psychoanalyze anything, but if I had to guess Stacy's time of death, I'd say it was around 9 p.m. that night because that's when Fennell said that she, quote unquote, went to bed. And that actually perfectly lines up with the timeline of that night based on the lividity and the time the truck was discovered and abandoned. So Stacy is dead, face down, someplace in the apartment, and Fennell is beginning the process of the cover-up. He's a cop, so he knows there are some steps that he needs to take to make this appear as though Stacy was intercepted on her way to work, attacked, raped, killed, and dumped. So she's gotta be at least partially dressed, and we know she had on blue pants with a broken zipper, green underwear with a wet crotch, and a black bra. It appears as though Stacy was in the process of getting undressed in order to take a shower. But why did she stop? Fennell said they showered together that night. But I say, what if he wanted to shower with her and she didn't want to? What if she didn't want to get undressed or in an intimate situation with Fennell because she may have still had the telltale signs of having engaged in sexual intercourse recently and really didn't want to be intimate with Fennell that evening, and that included him joining her in the shower? I mean, ladies, think about it. Sometimes they want to get intimate at times when you just really aren't feeling it for one reason or another. Don't you think having engaged in unprotected sexual intercourse with another man less than a day earlier might be one of those times? When you know you just want to get into the shower and you want to do it on your own? I don't know, I really haven't been there, but I could see it happening. I can see Fennell wanting to get into the shower with Stacy and her turning him down. And how is a man like Fennell going to react to that sort of slight, that sort of rejection? We can't know for sure, but we can infer based on what we know about him. We know he's controlling and possessive of Stacy. We know he has a history of violence against women. I mean, Fennell's rape conviction did not occur until 12 years after Stacy's death, but that did not just happen out of the blue. There had been numerous reports made by women against Fennell that nothing ever came of those accusations. There was only one prosecuted. And I promise I will tell you the details of that case, because she did come forward and she did speak to the media of the incident. Anyway, there could have been any number of things that could have set him off that night to lead him to do what we are alleging that he did. I wish we knew, but we can only speculate. And unless Fennell is going to have his own personal come-to-God moment and explain the evenings of that night, which I seriously doubt will ever happen, then we're never really going to know. So Fennell becomes angry with Stacy for whatever reason. Maybe she really isn't doing anything to try and pacify him. I don't know what type of personality Stacy had when it came to standing up for herself. I mean, she was only 19. But she had been through a lot in her short time on Earth. She had sisters, and they appear to have strong personalities to me from what I've seen on TV. Stacy had already been pregnant at least once, possibly twice, had given birth, gone through the difficult decision of putting that child up for adoption. At the time of her death, she was getting a good start into the workforce. She certainly wasn't being faithful to her relationship with Fennell. And as I've said, there were rumors aside from Rodney that she was seeing other men too. Obviously, she did not think she would end up dead, but she definitely did not shy away from doing whatever she wanted to do with little to no consideration of the consequences, and maybe she really didn't care. Stacy's family liked to say that she was in love with Jimmy Fennell. She was looking forward to getting married. But honestly, I don't see it. You know where I think Stacy was in her life? I think she was experiencing her first real taste of independent adulthood. Remember when we all got there? For 18 years, we lived under our parents' roofs. We have the rules to abide by, but after high school, you know, we get into college. Some of us get into jobs. Some of us move out on our own for the first time. It's our first real experience of being on our own, with our own money, with our own rules. How many of us went a little off the deep end with that? Maybe Stacy got to that place in her life. I mean, think about it. She was only 15 when she had a baby and chose to put the baby up for adoption. She was barely in high school. So what was the rest of high school like for her? What was her home life like? I haven't heard much talk about her dad, but we know her mom and her sisters were a presence in her life. After having gone through a pregnancy and adoption, is Stacy's family going to want to try to rein her in a little bit? Are they going to want to keep an eye on her and make sure she stays out of trouble and focuses on school rather than boys? Yeah, it's not out of the realm of possibility. Maybe Stacy even put those limitations on herself. That could have been a frightening thing to go through at such a young age. I mean, I was 24 when I got pregnant and I was scared. I can't imagine being 14 or 15 years old and having to deal with that. So maybe the rest of Stacy's high school experience had a few more rules and a few more restrictions and a few more limitations due to the fact that she had become pregnant at such a young age. But Stacy made it out of high school, and before the ink was even dry on her diploma, she met Jimmy Fennell. She was only 18, and he was a little bit older, maybe 22 or so, and he was on his way to becoming a cop. And before even a year had passed from the time they met, they are engaged, they are living together, she's working a full-time job and planning a wedding. And according to one of her friends, she confided in him that she was pregnant in, I believe, February of 1996, but had a miscarriage. And based on what we know of Stacy's actions leading up to her death, who's to say she even knew who the father of the baby was? So Stacy has gone from high school graduate to working full-time, living on her own with Fennell, and about to become a cop's wife. That's a lot for any young person. Those are huge transitions in life. But at the same time, in conjunction with all of this, Stacy is experiencing adult independence for the first time in her life. She is not having to live right under the nose of her mother and her sisters. Not that she took issue with that. It's just, you know, no matter how close we are with our families, we're going to have a different lifestyle the first time we move out on our own. Stacy's got her own money. She's got her own place. She's got her own job. This can definitely be a recipe for a good time. You can go out. You can party. You can have fun. You can date. Except, small detail, she's engaged to a cop. So maybe she can't go out or party or have fun or date. But she wanted to. And she did. In order to do all the fun things she wanted to do, in order to be out on her own and away from her parents and her sisters, the only way she could do it was to latch on to Fennell. With him, she could afford to live on her own. She could use his truck whenever she wanted. So her life sort of morphed into two different facets. The responsible, hardworking Stacy, committed to becoming the wife of a cop, and the Stacy that wanted to sow her oats, to get out into the world, to see things, to do things, to meet people, to be her own person for the first time in life. It is not an uncommon story, except for the fact that not everyone gets murdered over it. So back to my theory of that night. Fennell's got Stacy dead face down, either in the apartment, possibly in the truck. Lividity is pooling on the front side of her body, and Fennell has got to stage the crime as if it happened on her way to work. And in order to make this happen, he's going to need help. So he gets in touch with David Hall, his best friend, his neighbor, his little league co-coach, his patrol partner. Do I believe a friend like Hall would help cover up the murder of his buddy's fiance? Absolutely, without a doubt, I believe that. Especially if Fennell tells him that Stacy was messing around with him with a black guy. And I'm pretty certain that if Fennell is talking to Hall about this, he is not referring to Rodney as a quote-unquote black guy. I 100% believe that these two men are thick as thieves, that they trust each other with one another's lives, and they'd absolutely cover up a murder for each other and take it to the grave. Now, if Fennell would ever get charged with Stacy's murder, I think Hall would roll over on him in a hot second to save his own skin, because that's just how men like this are. They're narcissists. If Hall is willing to cover up a murder and dump a body, he's no better than Fennell. And hey, you know, maybe someday Hall is going to want to off his wife and his best friend there owes him one, right? So, I don't know how Fennell would have gotten in touch with Hall. He may have called him. He may have gone over to the house. They were neighbors. Did they check Fennell's phone records? Probably not, because that may have implicated in something. Either way, Fennell got Hall over to his place and they put their heads together in order to figure out how to cover this up. There are some details about the case that lead us to believe or infer that a cop had something to do with the cover-up of this crime. For one, there was the condition of Stacy's fingernails. They were said to have been cut extremely short, down to the skin of her fingertips. But they also had an appearance of being kind of jagged and not cleanly cut. I've looked at the images of Stacy's fingernails and they do look a little jagged, similar to how a nail would look if they were bitten off like a nail biter. But if you've ever known a nail biter, their nails are usually really, really short and way down past where they would normally be if they were simply cut, to the point where it almost looks painful. Every nail biter that I've ever known barely has any nail left to bite. Her nails do not appear to me as though she was a regular nail biter. Now, I'm not sure where I am with the condition of her nails, but the inference is that her nails were cut in order to eliminate the possibility of any DNA being found under her nails, say if she had fought for her life against her killer and scratched him in the process. Was Fennell checked for scratches? Of course he wasn't. What a surprise, right? But how often does that happen? When a victim has suffered a ligature strangulation and, oh look, the last person to be with the victim has scratches on his face, neck, chest, or arms. Fennell's body was never checked. He was never examined for injuries the day that Stacy was found. Whether or not Stacy's nails were cut to prevent them from being tested for DNA is only an inference that's been made based on the condition of her nails. So as Stacy's body is laying lifeless, her blood is continuing to pool, and she will be laying there for such a period of time that the lividity that is developing will become fixed. Now, it's possible that either Fennell or both Fennell and Hall brought Stacy's body downstairs and placed her in the truck face down on the floorboard, and that is where lividity developed. We know that she was face down because of the purge mucus that was left on the floorboard. Wherever Stacy was, whether she was in the apartment or in the truck, she was left in that position for at least 4 to 5 hours. So these two, they're going to attempt to make it appear as though Stacy was attacked after she left for work. They decided that they needed to dump Stacy's body someplace along the route between Giddings and Bastrop. They settle on Bluebonnet Road. It's not quite all the way to her place of work, about 6 or 7 miles away or so. Fennell is driving his truck with Stacy's body and Hall is following him there. What is he driving? We can't be sure. Carol's car was ruled out because she was said to have been in possession of both sets of keys to the car. And I believe a witness said that they saw a light-colored Ford Tempo drive by sometime in the middle of the night, but we really can't know for sure. Remember, Stacy's mom is definitely Team Fennell, so she was going to provide information that is favorable to him. I am not saying she is being untruthful. I'm saying she is going to tell the story as she sees it. Why does Stacy's mom and her sister stand by Fennell even after all these years in the face of all the evidence that has come to light and the fact that Fennell is now a convicted rapist? It's because acknowledging that Fennell might very well have been the one to kill their daughter and sister would mean to be forced to acknowledge that Stacy was having an illicit affair with an African-American man in a town where interracial dating was largely unacceptable and looked down upon. I think the narrative that this big, bad black guy raped and killed Stacy is preferable to Stacy was involved in a sexual relationship with said big, bad black guy, no matter what the science says, no matter what Fennell has done in the years following Stacy's death. That's the narrative that her family wants to believe. So David Hall could have taken his own vehicle and followed Fennell to the dump site as well. Either way, they drove in tandem to the dump site. So as to the things found in the car, the seatbelt was still buckled, if you recall. I questioned this and I asked the admins of Rodney's Facebook page. If the theory that Stacy was intercepted on her way to work and pulled forcibly from the car without unbuckling the seatbelt is untrue, why is it that her seatbelt was still engaged when it was discovered abandoned? I was told that it is not uncommon for police officers to drive with their seatbelts buckled to sit on top of the buckled seatbelt in order for it to be easier for them to get in and out of the vehicle quickly. I'm not quite sure how I feel about that because, one, why not just leave the seatbelt unbuckled unless the truck makes that really annoying beeping sound that your seatbelt isn't on, so he buckled it to prevent that from happening. I'm also skeptical because this wasn't his work vehicle, it was his personal vehicle. So is he needing to always be prepared to jump out of the vehicle at any moment? Maybe, but I'm not quite sure on this theory. But it could also be something that Hall and Fennell discussed. If they wanted to make it appear as though Stacy was accosted while she drove, maybe one of them said, "Hey, let's make it look like she was pulled out of the car so violently that the perpetrator didn't even bother unbuckling the seatbelt." In other words, this was a detail that was part of a really well thought out plan here. There are also pieces of the broken cup. They could have been broken in the process of either loading and unloading Stacy into the truck, but the inference there is that there was a struggle that took place in the truck as Stacy was being attacked on her way to work. Then there were the items found at the scene where Stacy's body was found. The piece of belt that she was strangled with, the t-shirt, and the name tag. Now I want us to carefully think about this for a moment. Why would Stacy's killer leave those things behind with her body? Why not just leave those things in the truck? It's going to be abandoned anyway. What difference does it make if those items were with Stacy or in the truck? We already know all of those items were with Stacy in the truck to begin with. Well, I say it was meant to deflect from what was really going on. Those items were left there to tell a story. It was meant to say, "Look, here is Stacy. Here is the t-shirt that she normally wears to work. Here is Stacy's belt that she also wears to work. And here is Stacy's name tag, also an item she needs for work." To everyone on the outside looking into this crime scene, to the people who are going to come here and discover this horrific event, see what the crime scene here is telling you? The narrative is that Stacy was abducted, raped, and killed on her way to work, and here she is with all of her items that she normally takes with her to work. You see? Clearly, these items were planted on purpose. Especially the name tag, and how it had been so unnaturally placed right there in the crook of her knee to make sure that it wasn't overlooked because the area was so overgrown with brush and shrubs. The person staging this scene wanted to make sure it appeared as though Stacy was equipped with everything she would have with her at work when she was killed. And not as though she was preparing to call it a night at home getting ready for a shower in bed. The name tag especially screams crime scene staging, at least to me anyway. And I don't mean to beat you all over the head with this, but think about this whole scenario from the perspective that Rodney did this. If he stopped, kidnapped, raped, killed, and dumped Stacy, why would he take the time to plant the belt, shirt, and name tag along with her body? What difference would it have made to Rodney if he had left those items in the truck or not? We all know that those items were in the truck anyway, so why would Rodney choose those three items to leave behind with Stacy's body? They were clearly chosen on purpose in order to bolster the narrative that Stacy was raped and killed on her way to work. How or why would that have made any difference to Rodney? The only reason it would have is if Rodney used his own vehicle to commit this crime. And he did have a vehicle, but it almost never was in operating condition. He was often seen walking around a lot, and Stacy was the one who picked him up when they got together, according to him. If the crime had been committed by Rodney using his own vehicle, then yes, he would have every reason to ditch any items Stacy had with her at the location where he would leave her body. He would not want any evidence in his car that she was ever with him, right? But that isn't what happened. The state has said Rodney got into Stacy's truck, dumped her body where it was found, along with three specific items that belonged to her. Even though the shirt was identified as Fennell's, we've established that she often wore a white t-shirt under her HEB shirt. Otherwise, nothing belonging to Fennell was left with her body. All of the items there were associated with Stacy and what she took to work. There were plenty of other items in the truck that could have been chosen to leave behind. The truck contained an HEB pen, a knife and a metal cover, a metal box cutter, a pack of gum, pieces of green plastic cup, a brown planner, a white napkin, carbon copies of checks, a gas emergency book, an ATM receipt, a bridal shop receipt, a Walmart receipt, a business card, a plastic bag, blue nylon rope, and brown rope. Yet of all the items Rodney would have had to choose from to discard at the scene with Stacy's body, how is it he would have chosen three items that are things Stacy specifically brought with her to work? Well, based on what we know in terms of who committed this crime, he didn't. The person who discarded Stacy in that ditch chose those three items deliberately in order to fit a narrative that he was creating. Then there was a location of where the truck was abandoned. Why the high school parking lot? It's kind of conspicuous, right? Could the person who did this want the truck to be found quickly? Well, yeah, I'd say so. I think the high school was chosen deliberately, knowing it would not take long for an officer to spot it looking out of place. Who is going to know where a truck is going to look suspicious at that early hour of the morning? A cop, maybe? If Rodney did this crime, is he going to hide the truck in plain sight? This is his neighborhood. And generally, when a person commits a crime like this, they're hoping to put some time and distance between himself and the crime. He's going to want to leave the truck someplace where it isn't going to be found so quickly. And as for Stacy's body, I believe I read somewhere that the belt was placed in a more conspicuous place where it might have been noticed by a passerby who would possibly want to inspect the area a little bit more, especially when the news broke that Stacy was missing. A piece of the belt would certainly grab someone's attention. Both places, where Stacy was left and where the truck was left, were meant to be found quickly. Who would need that to happen? Rodney or Fennell? Probably not Rodney. especially if Fennell knew Stacy had sex with Rodney recently, then he would have an idea that his DNA would still be there, and he needed that to be discovered and tested before too much time had passed. She had to be found quickly, and it only benefited Fennell. If Rodney had done this, he would not have wanted her and her truck to be found quickly at all. And then, a piece of the belt and Fennell's checkbook were laying outside the driver's side door when the truck was discovered in the parking lot. At first, I thought those items fell out accidentally when the person who parked the truck and exited the vehicle, those things fell out inadvertently, and the killer was going about what he was doing too hastily to care. But the more I thought about it, the more I started to think that those items were left there deliberately. Remember, Fennell is a cop, and he probably knows he's going to be a suspect as soon as the sun rises on the morning of April 23rd. I think he placed that small piece of belt next to his checkbook in order for it to appear as though someone was trying to frame him for the killing. There is no getting around the fact that his truck was used to transport Stacy's body. But just as the scene where her body was had items deliberately placed for a reason, I do believe Fennell planted those items next to his truck for the same reasons, to paint a narrative. Not only is this Fennell's truck, but look, an item belonging to him was left behind. People are going to think, wow, Fennell is a police officer. Wouldn't he know better than to leave something so incriminating behind at the scene, right next to a piece of the murder weapon? I believe that checkbook was placed next to a piece of the murder weapon in order to make it appear as though it was an amateur attempt to frame Fennell, because he would have and should have known better. Fennell isn't too worried about being incriminated because, for one, it is his truck anyway, there's no denying that, and he's a cop, so he's going to inherently be given the benefit of the doubt and the royal treatment by his fellow officers. He purposely made it appear that someone was trying to link him to the murder weapon by placing his checkbook near it. A cop would have been much more careful about dropping potentially damning evidence at a scene like that. To me, it's a pedestrian attempt at creating another red herring by the killer. So right now, let's back up to Bluebonnet Drive and the scene where Stacy's body was found. Remember, I've opined that David Hall is now present with Fennell, helping him with the disposal and the cover-up. He has followed Fennell in a second vehicle to the scene that he has chosen to leave Stacy's body. He's likely parked someplace nearby and remained in his car while Fennell removed Stacy from the vehicle and dragged her to the place where she was ultimately found. The way Stacy's arms were positioned above her head, and the way one of her shoes was removed and left behind in the truck, and from some post-mortem scratches that were found on her back, it is believed that Stacy was dragged by her feet to her final resting spot. Fennell returned to the truck, grabbed a few items that should have been on or with Stacy as she made her usual drive into work, and planted them near her body, including placing the HEB tag in the crook of her bended knee. Meanwhile, David Hall is in his car waiting and perhaps drinking a beer. He drinks two beers, and he's probably drinking them pretty quickly out of nervousness, possibly out of a desire to get a little buzz pretty quickly. And when he is finished with his beers, he discards them on the ground outside of his vehicle. Fennell finishes with the staging of the scene. He gets back into his truck, and together the two of them drive the car over to the high school, where he gets out of the vehicle and places the piece of belt that broke off as Stacy was being strangled and his checkbook register on the ground next to the car. He gets into David Hall's vehicle and they drive back to Giddings together. Fennell goes back up to his apartment and quietly waits for the phone to ring with the news that Stacy failed to show up for work. And as he is waiting, he is preparing to slip into the role of concerned fiancé, all the while likely cleaning up any evidence of a struggle or anything violent having taken place inside his apartment. Then he just waited for that inevitable call. And once it came in, he sprang into action by jumping into Carol's car and searching the route Stacy would have taken had she driven to work that morning. And the rest is history. And dreamers, even if we suspend our belief in logic and common sense and continue to want to make Rodney somehow fit into this scenario, that Stacy encountered Rodney somewhere along her way to work, there is no evidence that he was anywhere along the route from her apartment to HEB. There is no evidence placing him inside Fennell's truck. And if he truly raped and killed Stacy at that time, there simply were things present at the scene that make it impossible for her to have been killed after 3 a.m. Most glaringly, the lividity. There is no possible way that Rodney sat around with Stacy's dead corpse to allow for the opportunity for lividity to set in. Besides, the truck was found at 5:23 a.m. So couple that with Fennell's story that Stacy left at 3 a.m., that would give Rodney about 2 hours, and that is being generous, to make the impossible happen. Even if you don't want to believe that Stacy and Rodney had a consensual sexual relationship, because that simply is not a thing pretty white girls do in 1996 Bastrop, Texas, it is still impossible for Rodney to have made Stacy that way that she was found between 3 and 5 a.m. I want to get back to the rest of the documentary since I interrupted myself with my whole theory about what happened to Stacy. There are a few more shady things that I have not even mentioned yet going on with the investigation and law enforcement. I've been so centered on the science because really, that is what ultimately is going to shed light on the truth here. The other stuff going on in the background with the investigative missteps, the potential conspiracies and cover-ups, as tantalizing as all of that is, and how much it works in favor of Rodney's case for innocence, the science, for me, trumps everything. The most difficult part of all of this, aside from the possibility of Rodney being put to death in a few weeks for a crime many people, including myself, believe that he did not commit, is the fact that in speaking up and speaking out about this case, in not staying quiet and allowing the state of Texas to carry out one of the greatest travesties of justice imaginable, to just stand by and do nothing. I know with everyone out there in the media, the TV shows, the celebrities, everyone who has signed Rodney's petition to stop his execution, that all of this is hurtful to Stacy's mom and her sisters, and all of her loved ones who believe justice for her will not be truly had until Rodney Reed takes his last breath. But you know what? Rodney has loved ones too. He has a mom and he has children and he has family and people who care just as deeply for him as Stacy's family and loved ones do for her. Don't they deserve the same consideration for Rodney's life as Stacy's? As much as Stacy deserves justice, Rodney deserves to be treated justly. And that boils down to the most fundamental principles that our country was founded on. And where we stand now today at this moment, I hate to break it to Stacy's family and loved ones. I'm sorry, but the person who strangled the life out of Stacy and threw her off the road and down into a ditch like garbage is not paying for that crime. You might despise Rodney Reed, just be filled with hatred towards him because he's been a criminal throughout his life. He's been accused of rape in the past. You might hate him for no other reason because he's black. And that is why hating him for what happened to Stacy is so easy. It's the simple answer. It's what feels right. Hating Jimmy Fennell, it's not that simple because he loves Stacy. He wanted to marry her. He wanted to have a future with her. He's on the same side as Stacy's family. He hates Rodney Reed for some of the same reasons her family does, but it's a little more complicated than just hating him because he's black. Or hating him not for what he's been convicted of doing to Stacy. No, not that. But rather what Rodney was doing with Stacy. He hated Rodney Reed for that. So much so it drove him to murder. Oh yeah, it's a motive as old as time. But why not kill Rodney? Why kill Stacy, the woman he loved? Because if Jimmy Fennell is going to go to jail for killing someone for the rest of his life, I think he'd rather see Stacy dead than anyone else. In addition, aside from Fennell being a coward, Stacy was the easier, more convenient victim. I think Fennell valued his life so much more than Rodney's that he would not even consider risking his freedom for killing someone that he despised so much. So I have to ask, if you're going to hate someone for killing Stacy Stites, isn't it worth knowing beyond a shadow of a doubt that you are, in fact, hating the right person? I'm going to go ahead and wrap this part up now. I'm not quite finished because I was sidetracked. I still want to go through the information presented in the 5-part documentary. Some of it I have already gone over, but there are still some details I haven't discussed yet. So we're going to go ahead and take this into 4 parts, and that should be enough to cover everything. So after you have listened to this, come on over to our Facebook page and share your thoughts about what we've gone over so far, or if you have any theories of your own. You can also find all the videos and documents related to Rodney's case on the Facebook page I joined dedicated to seeking the truth. It's called Rodney Reed, Innocent on Texas Death Row. And you can also do your part. If you think there is reasonable doubt as to Rodney's guilt, or if you believe he is actually innocent and scheduled to die unjustly in little under a month's time from now, then please visit change.org and sign the petition to stop the execution of Rodney Reed. If you want to go even further, you can call Texas Governor Abbott directly and make sure you speak with a live person and ask him for a 30-day reprieve. The number is area code 512-463-2000. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to these episodes. Again, I can't say it enough. Let's make sure Texas gets this right. Until next time, sweet dreams.